And our special guest tonight, Dr. J. Marvin Herndon, will be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. What do you do to take this theory now, Marvin, to mainstream physicists and astronomers?
Well, we go just a little step beyond that and begin to ask the question, well, what happens as the Earth begins to decompress to become the full size that it is now? And I've looked at that, and what happens is the dynamics of the whole Earth are affected. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with plate tectonics theory.
Sure.
All the textbooks cover it. And from the surface, it looks all fine. You see basalt coming out at the mid-oceanic ridge, moving across the ocean floor, and plunging into a trench. Well, that seems to explain a lot of observations. But if the Earth is the same size, what that means is you have to assume that that basalt is then recirculated through a solid mantle over and over like a conveyor belt. And there's been no evidence for that. There was another idea of dynamics that had to do with the expanding Earth, but no one at the time knew an energy source that had enough power to lift the mass to the extended radius. And so people even talked about the laws of nature changing or the fundamental constants changing. Well, what I've done is to combine those two things and look at it slightly different. So you have what I call whole Earth decompression dynamics, which is really the best part of those two seemingly disparate theories.
All right, now we've got to talk about abiotic oil for a moment, because this planet is divided and probably pushed more toward the fossil fuel end, which, of course, has had incredible political ramifications and everything else. I've got my own thoughts, but I'd love to get yours because you're the scientist. Mine is based on intuition and this psychic whatever I might have. Yours is based on real science.
Well, that and a little of the same thing, I think. Let me say this. I first learned about Tommy Gold's ideas about abiotic oil back in the 1970s, so I've sort of watched it from a distance. I didn't learn until just recently that actually the Russians had predated him quite a bit.
Right.
And it's a tremendous concept. Now, I think I have to suppose that we're prejudiced a little bit by thinking about coal, the fuel coal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are different types of coal. There's the real soft coal, the lignite, the bituminous coal, the hard anthracite coal. And we know that you sometimes split it open, and if you're real lucky, you find a fern leaf in there, in the image. There's a lot of reason to think that that stuff came from buried peat bogs, or at least to a large extent. So I think that's one thing that sort of carried the old idea about a biological source for petroleum. But to my knowledge, there is no real strong evidence that there is a biological basis for petroleum. I bought Tommy Gold's book, Deep Hot Biosphere, a couple of years ago, and read it very carefully, read it with the idea of finding out what was wrong with it. And I couldn't find anything.
No, you can't punch holes through his theories, can you?
No, it's very solid. Now, here's something that's quite interesting. I think your audience will find interesting with what you just heard in the last segment. Imagine Earth as a planet like Jupiter, surrounded with essentially 300 Earth masses of gas.
Mm-hmm.
how much of that gas is methane, which is the principal component of natural gas, or what oil, gold thinks oil's made from.
And we can see exactly what's happening on Titan, for example.
And what you find for the Earth is you're looking at more than one Earth mass, maybe 1.3 Earth masses of methane. So there is an association of methane with the formation of the planet. Unlike in the so-called standard model where the gases have all just gone away somewhere and you're just gathering up the ungassed material. So,
all right.
so that's something that I think may ultimately bear on this question.
And you say there could be huge lakes of this stuff underneath the mantle?
I have no idea, but I think that people should try to find out. I really think that it's in the national interest to find out for certain.
If it's endless, it shouldn't be this expensive, and we shouldn't be fighting all over the planet for it.
Well, what we should be doing is we should be conducting ourselves like a country that looks out after its own needs, its own resources, its own defense, and doesn't put those things in somebody else's hands.
How would we go about, Marvin, proving that this planet has abiotic oil as opposed to fossil fuels? Maybe it's a combination of the both. You know, maybe it is possible that plant life and vegetation and dead dinosaurs created some of it, but surely not all of it. How do we prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's abiotic oil here?
Well, I think what really needs to be done, if people need to do some serious thinking about where to drill some really deep holes. Now, the deep hole that was drilled in, where is it, Scandinavia or Russia?
Siberia?
Yeah. That wasn't a good choice, I think.
So how deep are you talking?
But they seem to have found some oil there, nevertheless. So I think one thing that we could do is have a very deliberate approach to drilling deep in different kinds of environments.
See, another reason why I just don't think it's all fossil fuel is because the ocean floor beneath it, when we're talking about thousands of feet deep, there are pools of oil, probably more oil under there than there is in the other regions we've already discovered.
And there's not much sediment in the oceans.
No. So there's no dead dinosaurs down there, and there's not enough plankton in order to create that.
Oh, I've long looked at that as a very, very likely concept and something that people really need to look at.
Is it replenishing itself? Is it used almost as a core lubricant? What do you think it is?
I suspect that it's just small amounts of it that get cooked a little bit and treated and turned into oil and find places where they can deposit and collect. Probably it happens near the base of the crust, because there's reason now from the work that I've just done to believe that we have a way of emplacing heat at the base of the crust. See, in the terms of the Earth's decompression, the mantle is the part that's really squeezed, and it will decompress and swell. It'll expand. But it's also soft enough that it can change shape and contour, and the expansion or the decompression will just propagate itself. But then it gets to the boundary of the crust. The crust is rigid. And so what you end up with is compression right at the base of the crust. Now, you probably know that whenever you compress a substance, it gets hot. You find that with a bicycle pump. When you use a bicycle pump, it gets hot. When you fill a scuba tank with air, the compressed air gets hot. Ice skates produce pressure on those narrow blades that melts the ice along a little bit, lets it slip.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, is what's happening at the base of the crust. Now, if you go in a mine, like a deep mine in South Africa, for example, the deeper you go, the hotter it gets. This is the so-called geothermal gradient. But if you plotted that and projected it to the center of the Earth, the amount would be astronomical.
Couldn't even get down there.
And so you don't really, it doesn't go all that far. It's just heating in the crust. And people have, for 50 years, made a lot of measurements of the amount of heat that's coming out of the Earth from the crust, and come to it turns out to be about 44 terawatts. That's 44 million megawatts. And that's more than could be produced by all of the radioactivity currently producing heat in the Earth.
Now, do you think the methane, before it's heated up, is in a gas form?
Oh, I think it's probably in a compressed gas. And my guess is when it gets exposed to the heat at the base of the crust, that's where it gets converted into petroleum. And I suspect that it comes up somehow along the secondary decompression cracks, the cracks that occur as the surface of the Earth tries to get larger to account for the swelling that's going on underneath it.
Is the methane constantly being produced?
I don't think it's constantly being produced. I think perhaps it was trapped there originally, and maybe being liberated to some extent. I don't think it's being produced per se. Now, it might be being converted to oil presently.
Which means we might have enough oil to last thousands and thousands of years.
We might. We might. No one knows for sure. But it's something that really ought to be looked at objectively. See, there are two things that should be above politics. One of them is education, and one is science. Because whenever politics start becoming a part, then things get skewed, they get slanted, you get special interests trying to get their way about it. And you've seen this with the school systems. The schools could be so much better. Science could be so much better. And it really, what we need is to have a national science policy that's not a political policy, but a policy that's for the nation's needs to say, let's go out, let's be objective, let's do whatever we can do to find out how the world really is.
You know, earlier I was talking about how much of a great physicist teacher you would be, and I'm not kidding. I remember my two science teachers in high school, Mr. Kiefer, who taught us physics, Mr. Strom, who taught us general science. And those guys had an impact on me to really get involved in the sciences, to really like it, and to want to digest it and just throw myself into it. A good teacher can excite a kid to go into that field. A lousy teacher, the kid will never be interested, generally.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, the highest praise or honor, I think, is to call someone a teacher. Because, you know, the word for doctor, as in doctor of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that comes from the Latin word docio, meaning I teach. So, I mean, this is really a high tribute, and that's these are very important people in our society, and they should be appreciated, not beaten down by a bureaucracy that is insensitive to the independent thought that people have.
Well, I believe everybody listening tonight, Marvin, who has a passion for something, had that one special teacher that motivated them or challenged them or got them to do what they've done.
Oh, I think that's right. And I have even a little story that I wrote for a book that just came out recently called Celebrities Remember Their Favorite Teachers. And I posted this on my website, understandearth.com. And it's just about that same topic. Everybody has one or more very special teachers who made real difference in their lives.
Well, you know, and a perfect example for me is I have grown to love history and historical events. But when I was in high school, I wasn't that interested in that. I was more interested in biology and science and chemistry and courses like that because of the teachers I had. My history teacher was the dullest teacher that I ever came across in all my years of going to school. This guy would have bored, he just would have bored everybody, mm-hmm. and he did. And nobody was interested in his classes, and subsequently, nobody in that school was interested in history.
Well, teachers are everything. And one thing that I'm really disturbed about in the American school system, we've gotten to such a consensus-only mentality that teachers only teach this one little story that everybody believes is true. And in science, that's not the way to do it. You should be teaching students to challenge present perceptions, to see what's wrong with things, and to find better ways. And because that's what the basis of science is.
You've got a picture of Galileo on your website, but you don't have any explanation about why he's there.
Oh, Galileo is one of my favorites. On my website, nuclearplanet.com, I have some quotations from him.
Now, you're not that old to have him as a teacher, are you?
not quite, but he's someone everyone could learn from. And one reason he's special is when he was making his discoveries, you know, he discovered the first four moons of the planet Jupiter.
That's right.
And he also discovered sunspots. And the Aristotelian professors at the universities said terrible things about him. He would tell them about the moons of Jupiter, and they would say, no, there can't be moons like that there. They just can't be. And he'd say, well, look through my telescope. No, we won't look through your telescope. If you see them in your telescope, it's because they're in your telescope, not around Jupiter.
Didn't they end up confiscating his telescope?
I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was put on house arrest. But other people fared even worse. Giordano Bruno, for example, ended up being burned at the stake in Rome. I mean, fortunately for me, burning at the stake has gone out of fashion.
How would you have liked to have, for teachers, Einstein, Galileo, Da Vinci, Socrates? Wouldn't that have been great? Isaac Newton?
Oh, it would have been great. And you know what you can do? You can I believe in this wholeheartedly. You go to the library, often in the old books, and you find the books that were written by these people who were so good. For example, I have a book on physics that was written by Max Planck. I have another book on thermodynamics by Enrico Fermi.
That's exciting.
And they understood it so they can teach it. One other thing about Galileo. What Galileo did is that at the time, scientific communications were all written in Latin. Galileo broke that tradition by writing his works in Italian, in ordinary Italian, so people everywhere could learn about them.
Stay with us. And I think there was a movie called Bob and Ted's Adventures or something like that that did almost exactly what I was saying, and that's to get the old teachers like the Socrates and those people. And it was almost like a time travel movie. It was a great movie. I'm going to open up the Fast Blasts next. We'll take Fast Blast questions for our guest, Dr. J. Marvin Herndon, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you like to listen on Streamlink, you know just how valuable that is. Those of you who are not part of Streamlink, there's much more than just listening off your computer. There's podcasting. There's downloading of some great programs. That's a whole package. As a matter of fact, they used to sell tapes of Coast to Coast shows for like $25 or $30 a piece. Now we're just talking about for pennies a day, you can get Streamlink and then download your current programs, and it's very affordable to do it that way. When we come right back, we're going to go to Fast Blast Questions for our guest, Dr. J. Marvin Herndon. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. And it's Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, not Bob and Ted. In case, Marvin, you were going to look for that movie, you'd never find it.
Oh, I know that. I thought about that as soon as you left for commercial.
It's a
great movie.
Oh, it is a great movie. And that, you know, it's got it all. It really does. Mark from Maine wants to know, again, if nuclear heat as an engine in the Earth center dies away, what does this mean, possibly the plate tectonics? Will that cease?
Well, I think the answer to that question is no, it really won't, because it's my understanding that plate tectonics, what we perceive of as plate tectonics, really relates to the decompression of the Earth. Getting back from an uncompressed state, a hydrostatic equilibrium. And I think that that will cease eventually when the Earth is finished. And the rate is very slow right now. One can make the assumption that the basalt that's coming from the mid-oceanic ridges is the volume of that basalt is the same as the volume of the cracks that it's filling. And then you can calculate that at that rate, the present rate, the Earth would have, in all of its lifetime, would have only changed in diameter about 2%. So it's really approaching the end of its lifetime. I think in times past, it was much more violent. You know, there were lava outpourings in Siberia that, if spread throughout the entire Earth, would have been a layer, you know, 10 feet thick all over the Earth. So I think that the Earth was much more dynamic in times past.
From Pueblo, Colorado, he wants to know if you know much about Velikovsky's theories.
Oh, yes, I do, because that was a really fascinating story for me back way back in the 60s, and that was the idea that Venus was a comet, and he made from historical references what sounded like a very plausible picture. And I remember when I first asked Harold Urey about that, Urey just bristled because it just ran counter to everything that man had ever done in science. And it's like one of these things that that people do. They put pieces together and try to make a picture, and not all the pictures are quite right. And I think that can be said of Velikovsky's, but it makes for an interesting story with a lot of tie-ins to the Bible, the raining manna from heaven, and so forth. And it's fascinating reading.
Worlds in Collisions.
Yes, yes.
Jack from Colorado wants to know if your theory of the nuclear core changes your perception of the age of the planet, as we all know it to be 4.5 billion years old.
Oh, no, not at all. That's all consistent. The same age, and it just is a little bit different about how things work on the planet.
So you don't believe the Earth is 6,000 years old?
No, I don't believe it's 6,000 years old. And that reference is brings to mind something. And I can't remember the man's name. I think he was a priest or bishop or minister or some church person back in the 1700s or sometime that went through the biblical genealogy and decided that based on that, that the earth could only be, 5,000 years old or something like that. And that's been taken as fact by certain religious groups. And they're so much scientific basis. I mean, there must be at least 20, I've never counted them, 20 independent dating techniques that can be used to show that the matter of the earth is much older than that. And what's sad about that is that that turns a lot of people away from religion. And there's a lot of good in religion. A lot of living with other people and raising families and doing good things. I mean, I'm not sure I'd want to be in a world where there was no religion. I think we'd have chaos. And so it's rather sad that probably people see that this 5,000 year old earth just doesn't make sense, and so they discard completely the concept of religion. And I think that's not good.
Okay, here's one from Damien in Houston, Texas. He'd like to know if we'll have a day where we'll have technology to a safe parameter from our Earth's 5-mile core to study it further as time progresses. I guess he's basically saying, when will we have the technology to really study this?
Well, the technology for really going inside of the Earth is a long way off, because matter is compressed to basically to half the size or twice the density. And so we're talking about impossibly a long time away, but yet we have the tools where the anti-neutrino detectors that people are trying to get into operation around the world will be one tool to be able to image the inside of the Earth to some extent. And the best tool that we have, though, is the human mind and the imagination and the insight and the things people can figure out to deduce how things are. But a direct approach is still a long way off.
Mark from Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, wants to know if you think we had an extraterrestrial influence with the creation or the formation of the planet.
I hold the kind of an idea that I think that extraterrestrial existence, if it could be proven, and I mean irrefutably proven, it would be the most fantastic, the most exciting discovery in all of the lifetime of humanity. It's just that I don't think we've had that evidence yet. And I sometimes wonder, when we do have an opportunity, if that is the case, what will we find? Will they be bad guys or good guys? So I'm not sure that we might be invited for dinner.
We may already have been.
It's hard to know.
Gary from California wants to know if you think the core might be powered still by the sun, if that's possible.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think it's powered by the sun. You've got 2,000 miles of rock in between. So it's pretty much there on its own.
Do you still go to conferences? Do you bring position papers? I mean, can you put your theories in like New Science, New Scientist?
New Scientist has done articles on my work. I can go to conferences. I rarely do. Mainly because most people that go to conferences are supported by government grants, and I'm not. But I could. And my work is being presented to the popular press throughout the world. There was a recent National Geographic program, for example, that I was on. And there have been programs made in Japan and Korea and England and... There's There was an article in Newton. There was an article in a magazine. It's like a TV guide. It's like a super TV guide in Germany about my work, about the georeactor. And what was curious, I gave the Christmas lecture a year ago at the Institute for Transuranium Elements in Karlsruhe, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was there, they delivered that week's TV guide, which is more like a big magazine with TV listings and big articles and so
sure.
forth. They delivered it to the room, and there was an article about me. And it was interesting because there was no connection with my being there. But the word is getting out, and this is why I'm really like Galileo for a lot of reasons, because he appreciated that the real important thing in science is to convey the knowledge and the understanding to people. I mean, he speaks of people who love science and all true lovers of science. And he was very interested in conveying knowledge to what you'd call ordinary people. And so I relate to that quite a bit, because these are often the people that are asking the really pertinent questions and the interesting questions.
If your theory's correct, what does that tell you about the universe, not just only the solar system, but the universe as a whole?
Well, let me talk about other solar systems.
Ah.
And this is interesting, because now, you know, astronomers are starting to image. They've imaged as many as 100 or more, 120, I forget the latest count.
And growing.
And what they find is gas giants that are close to their stars. As close as the Earth is to the Sun, and sometimes closer.
You're right.
Planets like Jupiter. Now, how was this explained in terms of the so-called standard model? Well, it was explained this way. The giant planets formed real far out and then wandered in because of drag against the gas. But remember, the gas is like ten thousandth of an atmosphere, so you don't have much gas to drag against. So you have to, when you're not on the right track, you have to make up strange stories to account for everything. But when in science, when you are on the right track, things fall into place naturally, and you're led from one discovery to the next, and all of the pieces just fall in place.
Why do they all march to the same tune? Everything in the universe seems to be functioning at the same way, same pace.
Well, the question, I have to ask you this. Are we talking about the universe, or are we talking about scientists? Because they're two different answers.
That's true. Universe first.
Okay, the universe is that the universe works a certain way. And we don't know all of the ways that it works, but it behaves in a certain way, and we try to understand that. And it behaves in a certain way here or around Alpha Centauri or wherever. And as you begin to understand it, it really becomes quite simple. For example, one consequence of my recent work is that there are only three processes during the formation of the solar system that account for all of the variety we see in the composition of the planets, in their geodynamics or their planetary dynamics, and in their terms of their internal structures. Low temperature condensation in the far outer reaches, high pressure, high temperature condensation in the giant gaseous protoplanets, and then the stripping away of the gases from the inner part of the solar system. And with all those three processes, everything in the solar system starts to make sense. So science, the world is really a very ordered place. And as we understand it, it becomes simpler. Well, I shouldn't say it's simple, because it's not simple, but We begin to understand why it is, and we can see that there is a structure and an order and a causality.
It's like it's alive, Marvin.
It is like it's alive. Our planet's alive, and but that's good. That's great. I mean, it'd be terrible if it were the other way around.
All right. I believe the planet's alive. I believe it's an organism all by itself. If this natural nuclear reactor, this 5-mile-wide core, dies out, does that mean the planet dies?
No.
Is it like the heart of the planet?
Well, it's the heart of the planet, but it also, well, what it really means is that life will no longer be easy. It's like humanity came into being at a very nice time. It's like humanity came into being in the springtime, and when the georeactor dies, it'll be like it's become wintertime. Only it's not a matter of simply of cold, but a matter of being bombarded with a solar wind that could do bad things to you.
Will it affect Earth changes, though, in terms of climate?
Oh, I think yes. And in fact, climate is one of the things that the georeactor probably has some real effect on. You know, you talk about the global warming. Oh, and this a whole story, a whole dimension.
And we talk about under ocean volcanoes, which are obviously heated from some source.
Yes, and that's coming from the whole Earth decompression dynamics, a heat source that I call mantle decompression thermal tsunami, where you have a decompression that extends through the mantle, and then it gets to the solid crust, and it can't move any further. It creates pressure and heat, and then something gives, and you open a decompression crack, a secondary decompression crack, and you spew out volcanic matter, and you cause earthquakes. And so that's one thing, and there's no reason to think that has to be constant. And one of the problems with the present approaches to the models that people use for global warming is that they have some underlying assumptions. And one of the underlying assumptions is that the heat that's coming out of the crust is constant. Another is that the sun is constant. And I think neither of those things are necessarily true.
Ted from Columbia, Tennessee says, you know what? Your theory explains why frozen methane is found at the bottom of the ocean.
Could very well be. Could very well be. It's certainly there could be a lot of methane trapped there. I appreciate your bringing that to everybody's attention.
Marvin, if people want to get a hold of you or email you, how do they do that?
Well, the easy way to do that is to go to understandearth.com, and there's an email link there. That's easier than remembering my other email address, which is mherndon@sand.rr.com.
Now, you haven't written any books yet, have you?
No, and I've been seriously thinking about it. I need to write one.
Yeah, you should. I think you'd have a lot of people fascinated by your theories.
Well, it's just that I'm slow in trying to find an agent and things like that, but I it's time to do that. You know, it was as if before the pieces weren't all together, and if you try to tell a story that's incomplete, it's hard to tell. Well, I think that I've put the last pieces into place, so it is a very complete story, and it's very tellable, and it needs to be told. And I will promise you that that's going to be a high priority in the coming year.
Let's take some phone calls when we come right back at the top of the hour. Our guest is Dr. J. Marvin Herndon. It's your turn. Phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll give you the numbers in just a moment.